It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to have you both in this morning.
Yes.
Yeah, how'd that interview go?
Did you say hi to Tim for us?
That is not where I went.
She had this non-disclosure form that she had to sign, and you know, she can't really tell us.
We were no comment.
Told not to discuss it on the air. All right, well, let's start out with local, and it looks like there is going to be a vote coming up for Seattleites in August.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was anyway.
It
was
okay.
The primary election is now in August, which is the ideal time for nobody to pay attention. But that is thanks to the Secretary of State and a couple of really stupid initiatives. But in any event, during that primary vote in August, we will now be able to decide, thanks to the City Council decision this week, on the bag fee. The bag fee, which was supposed to go into effect January 1st, but was set aside due to a court challenge from the opponents of the bag fee, which, oddly enough, don't really include anybody from Seattle. The Yes campaign wanting to keep the bag fee has already raised more than 1% of what the plastics industry has given to the other side. Fortunately, the Keep the Bag Fee campaign's average contributors have given, on average, $216 to the Yes for the Bag Fee campaign. That's only slightly less than the per capita per contributor average of the opponents of the bag fee, which is approximately $82,818.33. On the other hand, the Keep the Bag Fee folks are 98% from Seattle, as opposed to the opponents of the bag fee, which are, well, actually none of them are from Seattle. It really is a remarkable story of how a polluting industry has managed to buy its way onto the ballot in August. And I really think that should be a major part of the campaign, not just whether the bag fee is itself a good idea or not. I'm kind of mixed on the specifics of it, but, you know, the fact that we're voting on this at all, because a special interest managed to buy its way onto the ballot is just really, really troubling.
All right. Moving on, the state budgets were rolled out this week.
Well, the proposals for the state budget anyway. The Senate budget looks a little bit different than the House budget in Olympia, but they'll have to be passed and then reconciled with each other and then passed again, and then Chris Gregoire will have to sign off on them. But both of them were really, really brutal. They both relied entirely on cuts to make up the enormous shortfall in revenue that's happened in the state due to the economic downturn. The Senate cuts include some $877 million for public schools, another $511 million for higher education, and $785 million for health care. Some 45,000 of the 105,000 basic health plan slots are going to be eliminated, for example, an issue which wouldn't happen if we had, you know, a national health care plan that the states didn't have to make up for the lack of. The House was a little bit better on health care. It was worse on higher education. And the governor and the writers of the budgets in the House and Senate have both been insistent that there be no new revenues to make up for the enormous revenues that have been lost. And let's be clear, the problem with revenues in the state budget is a problem of the economic downturn, but it's also a problem of the structure, because the state does not have an income tax. It's reliant on sales tax, and property tax. And the sales tax in particular, it's vulnerable to economic downturns, because, surprise, surprise, people stop buying stuff. So it tends to be very cyclical, but it's also got a long-term problem in that the proportion of the economy that is actual goods and services that are subject to the sales tax continues to decline, so that all other things being equal, the amount of the economy that the state can use to fund itself continues to shrink, and if that percentage stays the same or declines, as has been the case thanks largely to Tim Iman, the state budget as a percentage of the economy continues to shrink over time. And over the past 20 years, that is exactly what's happened. So these cuts come on top of what has already been a long-term average decline in state services being offered. Now, Lisa Brown, who's the state majority leader in the Senate, was the leader of several Democrats who were floating the idea this week of an income tax, specifically an income tax on millionaires, on the top 1% of income earners in Washington State. Now, those folks would be subject to a 1% income tax. That's the maximum that can be done. And the news coverage of this, particularly in the state's largest and Seattle's only daily newspaper, the Seattle Times, the Times, for anybody who follows media in this city, is obsessively, religiously anti-tax, particularly anti-estate tax, which I'll get to in a moment. But they champion all forms of tax cuts, and there's supposed to be something of a firewall between how they take editorial stances with the editorial board and their actual news coverage. But their news coverage of Brown's proposal was equally dismissive, and this really underscores how much of a loss it is to have only one newspaper in the city, particularly when that one newspaper is so vested in the coverage of a story and so ideologically predisposed to one side of an issue.
Yeah, I found it kind of interesting, too, that in the Times coverage of Brown's proposal for a state income tax, they were adamant that, oh, if it passed, it would go to the courts because it, you know, it wouldn't pass muster according to the state constitution, yada, yada, yada. And I just looked at that and I laughed. I said, you know, if that were really the case, there wouldn't be state income taxes in nearly every other state.
I want to talk about that a little bit, because what they're relying on is a state Supreme Court ruling from 1933 that says that income is a form of property and therefore cannot be taxed, you know, with an income tax. Those types of rulings, which date from the very early days of income taxes in the United States, have been overturned in all but four other states. And there are a lot of constitutional scholars who believe that if it did go to the courts in this state, it would in fact be overturned here as well. It just hasn't been challenged in many, many years. The Times coverage ignored all of that. It just said, it made a blanket statement that, oh, it's unconstitutional, so it can never be passed. Which is an argument of the opponents. That's one of the ways in which the coverage was very slanted. And an argument and a set of issues that you would never know existed if you relied only on the coverage of the Seattle Times.
Exactly.
So it doesn't seem like the Times writing is really getting much better since the...
Well, I think a couple of things happened. Remember that the Times also is in tremendous economic peril. It really over-leveraged itself, particularly when the Blethins bought a newspaper in Maine that's hemorrhaging money left and right, and that they now cannot sell because nobody in their right mind would buy a daily newspaper. So they're really hurting economically as well, and they've had a lot of cutbacks as well in their news staff. And I think what the disappearance of the PI, because let's face it, SeattlePI.com is not a real competitor for anything except maybe, you know, the waste of pixel competition. But I think what has happened with the Seattle Times is that they're continuing to cut back on their coverage and the amount of time and energy they put into their news stories, because they don't have any competition, because there's nowhere else for people who want a daily newspaper to go in this city. What they don't understand is that daily newspapers are not the only competition for another daily newspaper right now, that people are relying on other sources for their information, particularly the internet, and in that regard, the Times does not have a monopoly, and they're getting their butts kicked.
All right. Moving on to national and this week's economic news.
Oh, yeah. I think actually this week's economic news was partially international, too, with the G20 and the G20 protests that went along with it. One of the things that I noticed, too, with the, particularly with the coverage of the G20 protests, which was, I have to say, far better in the international press than it was here in the U.S. press, is that we're talking about protesters taking to the streets in countries where there's much more of a social safety net than there is here in the U.S., and in places where the economic downturn has not been felt as sharply as it has here in the U.S. People are not getting kicked out of their homes at the same rate in London, for example, as they are here. You know, the housing market isn't great in Britain, certainly, but it's not to the extent that it is here in the U.S. where you can, just walking in the streets of Seattle, a fairly, still fairly prosperous city with a still fairly good housing market, you're seeing homeless people in neighborhoods you have never seen them before. And we don't have that same kind of level of protest here about the economic situation as a whole, as you see in London. I found that kind of interesting.
Yeah, and the flip side of that is you've got all the chattering hoobahs talking about the dangers of populism and the outrage toward banks. That outrage has been not nearly as severe or as pronounced, and it's been limited so far mostly to talking compared to what it should be and what it could be.
Yeah, and the interesting part, too, is that here in the U.S., where the crisis needs to be addressed most dramatically, we should all be up in arms about what our politicians are or are not doing. And some of the things that they're doing are actually going to make the situation much worse. And I want to just talk a little bit about the Treasury plan to bail out these big banks to take some of their toxic assets off their books. When you saw that Paul Krugman called this plan, when it was first announced, he called it the Cash for Trash plan. And other economists got on the bandwagon and said, this is not a great idea. I looked at the details and I said, oh my God, this is really, to me, this is really a taxpayer-funded shareholder bailout, because it's the last ditch effort of the Obama administration to try to save the banks before they either have to be nationalized or they have to go through bankruptcy process. And in either of those two scenarios, the shareholders would be the ones who'd lose the most, because they would lose their entire investment in these companies. So this really is a taxpayer bailout of shareholders, people who own stock in these companies. And you know, the details of the plan were billed as, okay, 7% of the money to buy these toxic assets will come from the private sector, and the government will fund the other 93%. But the taxpayers could, you know, make millions, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the truth is, when you look at who's lining up to participate in this investment program here a week or two after it was announced, we're seeing that the banks that are lining up to buy these toxic assets, and I will say that again, big banks are lining up to be the ones to invest in these toxic assets, banks like Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Citigroup, and Morgan Stanley. Those are banks that got, you know, government bailout funds already. What we're looking at is not a 93-7 split between public and private money. We're looking at 100% public money.
They're using the money they got from the government in the first place in order to buy these toxic assets.
Yes, yes. It is mind-boggling, the idiocy of this program. And if you look at the way it's going to be run, the key problem, the key issue that has been the problem all along in how to deal with these toxic assets, which is namely, okay, with any kind of cash for trash plan, any kind of buying up these toxic assets plan, is how do you value the assets? If you value them at what the market values them, which is at zero, then the banks don't benefit. And the plan won't work. If you value them at 100% of what they were issued at, then you're paying too much, clearly, and taxpayers will lose out. So the question is, how do you value it? That's been the key stumbling block all along. This does absolutely nothing to address that, by saying that okay, we're going to let private bidders decide how much these are worth. Well, the fact is, this plan is going to allow these private bidders to take government money and just pay whatever they feel like they want to pay amongst each other. So it's not as if you're bringing in any outside parties. You're taking these banks that have toxic assets on the books. They're talking to each other, sitting down, rubbing elbows and saying, okay, let's agree on a price here. You know, we're not risking any of our money, so it doesn't
matter.
Which
used to be called antitrust.
Yeah, which used to be called, you know, things like collusion.
Exactly.
And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's insane. It is insane. And it is going to make things a lot worse, and brings the level of price distortion with these assets to, I think, a new and record high. So, you know, if you're thinking that taxpayers will get anything out of this, you're kidding yourselves. And if you think it's going to help the problem, help clean up these banks' balance sheets, you're also kidding yourself, because if you don't have outside parties coming in to supposedly dilute the risk, coming in and buying up these risky assets to sort of dilute the risk or spread it out among the private sector, which was the idea behind the plan, if it's banks buying them from each other, they don't disappear. They're just trading hands, cash is flowing back and forth, and nothing is being done to clean up the problem. So, and I want to just mention another thing that our government officials are not doing. The Obama administration gave a plan to Congress this past week saying, look, we want you to draft some new regulations for the financial industry. And everybody said, great. Oh, the Obama administration is finally doing something about regulation. But when they looked at what Geithner and Bernanke and everybody gave these congressional committees, it was basically a sort of general, very vague layout of what they'd like to see in sort of vague terms. There was no specific legislation drafted, no specific details, you know. It was more of the same kind of, we want you to regulate, pat, let's pat you on the head, do something, and see you later. But don't do anything that's gonna actually force these banks to disclose any information.
Yeah, meanwhile, the looting and pillaging continues.
Yes, indeed. And then this week, again, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, this has actually hit the news, and people may have heard of it, which is great. I think more people should be outraged by it. It repealed the mark-to-market rules. Now, the mark-to-market rule required banks to take derivatives like these mortgage-backed securities and list their value on their balance sheet at what the market valued them at, so what they could get if they were trying to sell those mortgage-backed securities on the market today. Well, right now, a market doesn't exist. Nobody is willing to buy them, so their value is at zero. And banks complained to the Financial Accounting Standards Board and said, oh, my God, you know, we're having to write off all these things that we think have some value because people are still making their mortgage payments, right? You know, but instead of the Obama administration stepping in and saying, look, you can't repeal mark-to-market. Mark-to-market is necessary for the transparency of our financial institutions. We have to know what they have on their balance sheets. We have to know what their real-time, real market value is. Instead of stepping in and saying, okay, maybe banks shouldn't have these things on their balance sheet, maybe the solution is to unwind these things and renegotiate the underlying loans and get this crap out of here, they basically said, okay, let's repeal mark-to-market and let banks put whatever value they want on these things.
Now, maybe I'm a little slow here, but this raises an obvious question. Isn't the fraudulent valuing of these assets what got us into trouble in the first place?
No, what got us into trouble in the first place is allowing these loans to be packaged up and sold as securities. That's what got us into trouble in the first place, is designing these derivative products and allowing banks to buy and sell them. I understand
that there's a fundamental problem with them in the first place, but once they existed, the fact that they were valued essentially through magical thinking.
I think they were mostly designed and packaged and rated by the credit rating agencies with magical thinking, is
right.
What you're saying. And so that allowed people to overvalue them when they were buying and selling them in, say, 2005 and 2006. Well, now I think they're probably pretty close to their accurate value. People are looking at them and saying, these things are only worth pennies on the dollar. We're not going to buy them. So valuing them at zero is not too far off the mark. So the issue is, if we want to find out what these things really are worth, we need to unwind them. we need to say, okay, it's not a good idea to have these things we don't know what, to have these things packaged up in a way we don't know what they're really worth. We need to unwind them, renegotiate the underlying loans, and then we will know what they're actually worth.
But wasn't packaging them so that you wouldn't know what they're worth the whole point?
Yeah, it was. Yes, it was, Jeff. And a lot of people did make a lot of money off of it. And I'm sure those are the same people who are invested in hedge funds and who are the shareholders of these big banks and are pushing for these rules to be repealed. So that kind of brings me back around to what actually did happen at the G20 over this past weekend. What happened was it was sort of billed as a Europe versus the U.S. showdown. You know, the Obama administration went to Europe saying, okay, you guys need to do what we're doing, which is more government spending and getting on the economic stimulus bandwagon. And the Europeans came back with you need to clean up your financial system regulations first. You need to re-regulate your financial system because you guys are the source of the problem. And it was the lack of transparency and the lack of rules, the sort of Wild West atmosphere of your banking industry and your financial industry that got us in this trouble. And the truth is that both sides are right, but both sides are wrong as well. The reason that they're both right is that, yes, we do need to spend some money to help out people who are in dire straits, but the Obama administration is not spending money in the right places. They're pouring money into the top, into these big banks and so forth, and not helping people who are getting kicked out of their homes. And until you start spending money on unwinding some of these mortgage-backed securities and allowing people to renegotiate their loans and get their payments down and stay in their homes, then there's not going to be economic recovery. So he's right, but he's wrong. When it comes to the Europeans, they're right, but they're wrong as well, too, because the European idea of re-regulating has not been nearly what the financial industry needs worldwide. The Europeans are proposing things like regulating tax havens, listing tax havens so that we know which countries are providing tax havens, you know, and listing hedge fund companies so we know what companies do have hedge funds and which ones don't. I mean, just very minimal. They're talking about very minimal regulation when you need very deep and very comprehensive regulation.
I was really struck by how awful the American coverage of what happened at the G20 was in terms of the media here, in that two different things came out of the G20 that simply were not reflected in the coverage here. One was that Obama went to the G20 wanting them to undertake a certain regimen, and they basically slapped him down. And you would not know that from the media coverage, which basically treated them as though Obama went there and everybody treated him like he walked on water. The other thing you would not know is that the regulation that did come out of the G20, you know, you're hearing all of this coverage of there's regulation now, everything is better, and the regulation is nearly meaningless.
Yes, it's tiny baby steps in the direction that they need to go. I think the biggest thing that came out of the G20 agreement is what they called the recapitalization of the IMF. Basically, you know, things have been bad here in the U.S. and in Europe because of the economic downturn, but it's been worse in most other countries in the world. And there's a reason for that. It's because most of those countries are already impoverished because of IMF structural adjustment programs where these countries agreed to take loans from the IMF and then had to jump through hoops in order to get the loans, yeah, namely by cutting their social safety nets in their own countries.
And by the way, I seem to be on this jihad about media coverage today, but it's just been a bad week. But there's a front page story on WashingtonPost.com this morning talking about the IMF and how rejuvenated it is that does not make one mention of the failure of neoliberalism or how central a role the IMF had in creating those problems in the developing world in the first place.
Yeah, and now they've essentially recapitalized the IMF, given them a huge loan fund to turn around and loan more money to countries who you could argue need gifts. They don't need loans, essentially. So that's the big agreement that came out of the G20, and it has boosted the stock market, but it has not done a heck of a lot more for the economy, as we can see by the bad unemployment numbers that were released on Friday.
Did you want to go any more on the unemployment numbers?
No, but I do want to talk a little bit about a report that was issued by the, I believe it was the Comptroller of the Currency and the Office of Thrift Supervision, that looked at the loan modifications that banks are being encouraged by the Obama administration to modify some of their loans for. For people who have mortgages that they're having trouble making payments on, they looked at the fourth quarter last year, the loans that were modified in the fourth quarter, and they found that less than 50% of those loan modifications actually lowered payments for the people who went through the loan modification process by more than 10%. That actually, when they looked at the payments, that one in four of those loans, people were actually paying higher amounts every month. And you might ask, how can you go through the loan modification process and end up with higher payments? Well, when you don't make your payments, the bank charges penalties and interests and so forth. And when you give the banks free rein to modify the loan however they want to, with no standards from the government and no limits from the government, they're not going to forgive those penalties and those interests. They're going to add them to your balance and make you pay higher payments.
Yeah, it really is remarkable, as I alluded to before, how much of the pillaging and looting continues all the way through this crisis under the Obama administration for the past three months.
Yeah, so again, Congress and the Obama administration are falling down on the job by not setting standards for these banks, saying you have to modify a certain number of loans, you have to modify them in a certain way, et cetera.
All right, only a couple minutes left. Federal court ruling this week.
Yeah, very, very briefly, because we need to get to events and the fund drive. But federal court ruling on Bagram, the prison there. The three Bagram prisoners, like their counterparts in Guantanamo, have their rights to due process and can receive trial. The Obama administration had fought this ruling. They are making arguments really identical to the Bush administration. And the reason they're doing this is because of the closing of Guantanamo, that they want a place that they can take foreign terrorism suspects that's outside the due process arena, and they are simply trying to do the same thing as the Bush administration, but move it from Cuba to Afghanistan. So this is a victory for due process and civil rights, and an unfortunate reminder that meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
All right. And finally, did you want to get anything else in on the excellent coverage of the G20 protests?
Oh yeah, I think they were mentioned, and they mentioned that they're rabble and that they have no valid points. There are a lot of protests in London, and also in the last couple of days in Strasbourg and France and across the border in Germany. That'll be very familiar to anybody who followed WTO here in Seattle and some of the summits since then. You had squats being raided by police, even though the people there had done nothing wrong. You had a lot of, shall we say, aggressive tactics by law enforcement, and it'll all seem depressingly familiar, even though the critics of globalization have turned out to be pretty much spot on over the past decade.
All right. And events for this week?
Yeah, a couple of them today from 1 to 3 o'clock. If you are interested in finding out about conscientious objection to paying taxes for war, it's an act of civil disobedience, but it can be done. And find out how, 1 to 3 o'clock at University Friends Meeting, 40th and 9th Northeast in the University District. And then Monday, 10:30 in the morning, the City Council is having its budget hearings. That'll be at the Council Chambers at City Hall at 600 4th Street.
Very good. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System. We're on the web at www.eatthestate.org. We are in the midst of a fund drive, and we've gotten a very generous matching donation for gifts of $100 or more, up to $500, that you make the gift, and this person will double it. So they want to remain anonymous, but we're going to thank them a lot and encourage you to donate. It is a volunteer-only publication, the kind of news you hear here on the radio, and we need your help to survive and to continue to provide this kind of information. So go to www.eatthestate.org, hit the PayPal button, or send your donation to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. If you've got any questions, feedback on the program, or missed any of that information, give us an email. Our email is info@eatthestate.org.